Last week was Thanksgiving, and we gave thanks for our food, family, and friends. We also gave thanks for our homes, for the roof over our heads. Also last week, in our country, the United States of America, a superpower, there were thousands and thousands of homeless Americans who had much less to be thankful for.
So we have homelessness, but there's also the sort of people who are a much bigger group of people who are at risk of homelessness, who are precariously housed, who are paying a very disproportionate share of their income for housing, and who are thus at pretty imminent risk of losing that housing.
They're kind of like a paycheck away from homelessness.
Exactly. And the administration, in fact, took the position that homelessness is a choice. So 1979, the federal government each year funded over 300,000 new units of low-income housing, housing affordable to very poor people. 1982, that number goes down to just over 3,000. So that is an astonishing drop. Over 300,000 to under 3,000. And that's enormous.
Wait, 300,000 to 3,000? So that's 1%.
Yes. They have actually evaluated this, and they save more money than they spend through this investment.
Because they're solving the problem.
They're solving the problem. And homelessness costs money. So it's easy for us to think, sitting here in the U.S., that, well, doing nothing doesn't cost anything. But that's not true. And there are studies here in the U.S. that show that doing nothing is actually very costly. In particular, the Ninth Circuit has had two major decisions in the past 5 years that are very strong on this point. It's cruel and unusual punishment, violates the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, to make it a crime for someone to sleep on the street when they have no other place to go.
Oh, wow. Did you know that homelessness has not really been a part of America's history? Yes, we have had homeless Americans. But aside from the mass homelessness crisis of the Great Depression, America did not really suffer from a recalcitrant homelessness crisis until recent decades. As I searched for an interesting digital history to share with you here, I realized that this is probably the most important point to tell you about, especially for younger Americans who may assume that homelessness has always been a part of our history. No, homelessness has not been a constant part of America's history, and it doesn't have to be a part of our future. Hey there, News Peelers. Today is Wednesday, November 29th, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. Earlier this year, I read a Wall Street Journal report with the following headline, quote, "More Americans are ending up homeless at a record rate," end quote. This article points to several factors as causes of this crisis in America. Prominent among them is the steep rise in housing costs. As if to follow on that Wall Street Journal article, the New York Times reported last month on an investigation by the California Department of Housing and Community Development, which determined that no city put up more housing development roadblocks than, can you guess which city? San Francisco. A beautiful city that I once lived in. A city that is now plagued by homelessness. According to this New York Times piece, quote, it takes longer and costs more to build housing in San Francisco than anywhere else in California, end quote. This lack of affordable housing has caused many San Franciscans, such as teachers, police officers, and firefighters, to search for homes far away from the city by the bay. As for low-wage workers, well, they either live in their cars or on the street. But this episode is not just about San Francisco. It's about the burgeoning problem of homelessness in every city and state in America. I'll give you one example that really surprised me. Earlier this year, I stumbled on a Wall Street Journal article about homelessness in Missoula, Montana. And I'll just read you the title of that article because I think it speaks volumes about what's happening in our country. Quote, a Montana town faces a homelessness problem similar to San Francisco and LA, end quote. This article surprised me because Montana is a Republican state. I know this sounds naive, but I always associated homelessness as a problem of Democratic states, like California and New York. The second reason that this article surprised me is that during our relatively recent week-long vacation in Montana, we didn't get any indications whatsoever that homelessness may be a problem in Montana. You may say, well, Adele, you spent all your time in vacation spots. Yeah. But in California, even vacation in small towns, after a couple of days or so, you may see homeless people. That wasn't our experience in Montana at all. Here's another example from a Republican state. Homelessness in Dallas has worsened over years, and it now has the highest homeless population in Texas. The good news is that another big city in Texas, Houston, a big city, has decreased its homelessness by more than 60% since 2011. According to the New York Times, Houston achieved this goal because 1. It has strong political leaders, 2. It has regulations for building new housing, and 3. It laser focuses its energy on moving homeless people into apartments and keeping them there. So while the story about Houston is great news, how about the rest of our country? And why is this happening anyway? Yes, I know, housing is expensive, I got that. But I ask again, why is this happening? In America, a country that is supposed to be a superpower. Let me ask it this way. If hundreds of thousands of our countrymen and women don't have homes, then what is so super about America's power anyway? And how did we get here? Did we take a wrong turn somewhere in our history? Did we miss the flashing signals about the exigencies of homelessness? Did we not see this massive oncoming crisis? To get answers to these questions and more, I spoke with Professor Maria Fascarinas of Columbia Law School, where she serves on the Public Interest Public Service Council. She's a founder and former executive director of the National Homelessness Law Center, a very important institution about which Professor Fascarinas tells us in this episode. Before founding the National Homelessness Law Center, she established and directed the Washington, D.C. office of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Professor Fascarinas has advocated for solutions to homelessness at the national level since 1985. She's a primary architect of the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act and has led successful litigation to secure the legal rights of homeless persons. Among her many honors and awards, she was named a Human Rights Hero by the American Bar Association's Human Rights Magazine. To learn more about Professor Fascarinas, you can visit her academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Professor Fascarinas and I peel the history behind this news. So I'm excited to share with you the news that in January 2024, we will launch a whole new weekly podcast. It is a series on the Middle East, its in-depth history and analysis. Unlike the History Behind News, this Middle East series is a special program that will not necessarily follow the news. Rather, we'll ask the big questions, the fundamental questions. For example, who are the people of the Middle East? What are their genetic compositions? How did Aryans end up in the Middle East? To what extent did the Mongols destroy the Middle East? And who the heck is Tamerlane anyway? After destroying the Middle East, why did he stop at the border of Europe? How did Turkey become full of Turks? How did Egypt lose its status as a Shi'i nation? And how did Iran lose its status as a Sunni nation? Why did the Middle East fall behind Europe? And is the Middle East truly a troubled region? And how has America's foreign policy in the Middle East, to the extent that we have one, has changed over the decades? Click the newsletter link in the detailed caption of this episode and we'll email you at the launch of our new Middle East podcast. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Professor Foscarinas about America's crisis of homelessness. Professor Foscarinas, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
I'm glad to be here, of course.
For how long has homelessness been an issue in our country?
So the present crisis of homelessness, mass homelessness as we know it today, really launched in the 1980s. The early to mid 1980s is when it exploded. That's not the first time that homelessness has appeared, however, on a mass scale. I would say the first time was during the Great Depression and in the 1930s. That's a period of time when millions of Americans lost their homes and were literally out on the street. And there were shanty towns and later called Hoovervilles.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a time of mass homelessness. That eventually that was alleviated, that receded, and the country entered a different phase. And it really did not, we really did not see mass homelessness again until the early to mid 80s, as I said. So that is really when the crisis started. And I think that's a very important point to make because people today, especially younger people, often assume homelessness has always been part of the United States.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Context. And it has not. It has not. There was a time when, you know, there were people who were homeless before this, what I'm calling an explosion in the 80s, but they were limited. You know, there were skid rows in major downtown areas of big cities. Those primarily, people living there were primarily single men, often with a drinking problem, primarily white single men. But that was a very limited and different kind of population than what we're seeing now and what we started seeing in the 80s.
Just wondering, you said that the homelessness, the mass homelessness of the Great Depression, that spike, we had an economic calamity in the 1930s.
Exactly.
When was that alleviated? By the 1940s, after during World War II and after? Am I guessing this correctly?
Yes. Well, the first thing was President Roosevelt and his New Deal. The New Deal was a direct response to the economic suffering that people were experiencing at the time, including homelessness. So the New Deal launched a series of social support programs, including the beginnings of housing programs. That's the time when the country first saw the development of housing assistance for people who needed it.
And that FDR launched nationwide national programs.
Yes, national programs.
I see.
Known as the New Deal. That's what FDR called it. It was the New Deal, and it was a response to the extreme crisis that was brought by the Great Depression. And that's when a lot of these social programs started,
Did the national programs work? Did we see their positive impact? Or was it World War II that solved this crisis?
Yes. I mean, I think that the World War II also played a role because, you know, the war economy created, I guess, ginned up the economy. I'm no economist, but my understanding is that there were two things. There were the New Deal programs, and there was also World War II. And that alleviated the crisis. And that held steady for some decades after that.
So we get into the 1970s and the 1980s, based on what you're saying, mass homelessness begins to pick up. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out, you see this perspective of someone who is not an expert such as yourself in this specific area. They look at the Great Depression. It's this big calamity, and then we don't have another one. I mean, the 1970s were bad, then we had the Great Recession. What I'm wondering is how does homelessness now compare to the past? Is it at its worst point?
I guess I can say, without trying to project exactitude, but mm-hmm. it's probably at the worst point since the Great Depression.
Oh, wow.
So I think that's a way to think about it, that Great Depression is a big calamity. Now it's, again, a big calamity. And I should say it's not just... So we have homelessness, but there's also the sort of people who are a much bigger group of people who are at risk of homelessness, who are precariously housed, who are paying a very disproportionate share of their income for housing, and who are thus at pretty imminent risk of losing that housing.
They're kind of like a paycheck away from homelessness.
Exactly. Okay. Or people who, by some definitions, now definition of homelessness is a whole big controversial topic, but some, you know, and there are different ways of defining it. One way of defining it is people who are either on the street, living in a public place, the people you tend to notice, the sort of what conjures up the stereotypical image of a homeless person, someone living on the street, maybe suffering from a mental health crisis or problem. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who don't fit that stereotype, first of all, who may be living in public and going to a job, who don't stand out, who you might pass on the street and not realize that they're homeless, or they might be living in a shelter. There's that kind of group of people who are either living in public or in a shelter. That's one definition.
Isn't that crazy? They have a job, they're willing and able, but they still cannot afford to live.
Yes. Or they're living in their car. This is probably the fastest growing group of people, living in their cars, and they lost their home. They still have their car, so they're living in their car. Many of them are working. There was just today's New York Times and yesterday's New York Times an article about this growing group of people, and it's, you know, these people are also homeless. They have lost their home, and they're living in their car. And similarly, there are people, this larger group of people who is doubled up. They've lost their home. They've been evicted. They've moved in with friends or family. And they're sleeping on someone's couch, sleeping on someone's floor, moving from place to place, lacking a stable place of their own. They're doing this because of economic necessity, not because they like living with their family or their friends, but because there's no other choice. So that, by some definitions, those people are also homeless. So now I've sent us completely off track. But
no, you haven't. You know, you're talking about fastest growing group of people that are becoming homeless. These are people that actually are working. I'm wondering, what does data tell us about this progression of homelessness, this sort of growing mass of homelessness from the 1970s to now? Do we have data that shows like an accelerating rate of homelessness? Do we have numbers for now?
So numbers are, and I want to get back to the 70s also, because I want to emphasize that the real, so what have, let me just talk about the 70s for a moment.
Please do.
So the 70s see gentrification really picking up. Gentrification, by that I mean neighborhoods developing in a way that displaces people. So inexpensive housing being torn down in favor of more expensive housing. And we see this primarily with what are called single room occupancy units. I don't know if that's a familiar term, SROs. These used to be prevalent in big cities primarily. So inexpensive accommodations, you know, you have a room with a shared kitchen, a shared bathroom. So it's a cheap kind of place to live, but it served a purpose for many people who could not afford anything more. These started to be torn down in the 70s and in favor of, by developers, in favor of more lucrative forms of housing. So that's what happened in the 70s. In the 80s, with the advent of the Reagan administration and the mission, that administration's mission to shrink the footprint of the federal government, that was a stated goal of the Reagan presidency. And many of these social programs launched initially during the FDR era were cut. And housing in particular took a very big hit. So that's why I zero in on the early 80s, early to mid 80s for this dramatic increase. Now you're asking about numbers.
Yeah.
I don't have good numbers. No one has good numbers on homelessness.
Why is that?
It's hard to measure. It's difficult to it's difficult to measure a population that doesn't have a home. Most of our data collection, the country's data collection mechanisms, like the census, for example, depend on an address.
Yeah, you go and knock on doors, literally. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Or you put something in the mail.
Uh-huh.
But people who are homeless don't have a door. They don't have an address or a mailbox, generally. So the standard methods are not going to work. There are ways to measure, and there are people, experts, who have estimated based on those other ways. But the official ways, the government counts homeless people, and there is an official way. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development requires communities, cities, mainly, that receive federal dollars from HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, they must carry out a count each year as a condition of receiving funding. They have to carry out a count of their homeless populations. And these counts usually get a lot of publicity. You may have heard about them. Your listeners may have heard about them. They're often kind of publicized in communities. They sometimes attract a lot of volunteers, and they're a good way to engage people. But they're not.
They make it to the news. For example, the number of homelessness in Los Angeles is skyrocketing, that sort of thing, right?
Right, exactly. And undoubtedly it is, but these counts are very inexact measures. So what the counts do is they take a single night in January and they count people who are in shelter. That's pretty straightforward. But the problematic part is people on the street or living in public. So they recruit these volunteers, volunteers fan out, and literally visually count people. And this is very hard to do. I mean, first, you're depending on people who are not trained. They receive a very cursory training. And then they have to make a judgment call. Is this person homeless? Is this person not homeless? They have to cover vast parts of a city. And so necessarily, this is going to be a very, very approximate number. So that's why we don't have good. And they may use different methods year to year. So it's not even a great way to sort of get comparative information to identify trends.
Does this create issues for receiving local or federal funding or donations? Because at some point you got to say how many people I'm helping, but the number is not, you know, for certain, right?
Well, you can say how many people you're, you know, if you're providing shelter beds or serving meals, you can say how many people. But you're right. I mean, you don't, there is a lack of real data that's reliable.
There are
ways to compensate for this, and people who are experts on this kind of thing have them, and there are statistical ways of approximating, but they're not the official count.
Interesting. Let's take a break here and then talk about how we got here and how did it get so bad. On October 25th, just over a month ago, a mass shooter killed 18 people and injured 13 in a small town in the state of Maine. So, what was he thinking? What led him to that point of explosive and murderous rage? In fact, what triggers most mass shooters? And how are they different than other murderers? Join me next week in conversation with a scholar about the psychology of mass shooters. You can do that by following the History Behind News program on your favorite podcast platform, or just click the newsletter link in the detailed caption of this episode, and we'll email the episode to you when it's ready, along with a brief description and videos of me and my guest. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Professor Foscarinas about America's homelessness. Professor Foscarinas, how did homelessness become such a dire problem? And I'm wondering, almost philosophically, did we take the wrong turn somewhere? Did we miss all the signals along the way? You know, my hometown of San Francisco has a huge homelessness problem. No one wants this, Republican, Democrat, rich, poor. What happened?
Right. So I'll go back to the early 1980s, and that's really the first crisis point in recent times. So 1979, the federal government each year funded over 300,000 new units of low-income housing affordable to very poor people. Over 300,000 units. I think it's 147,000, something like that. 1982, that number goes down to just over 3,000. So that is an astonishing drop. Over 300,000 to under 3,000. And that's enormous.
Wait, 300,000 to 3,000? So that's 1%.
Yes.
Wow.
So this is a huge cut. This is why I'm emphasizing the early to mid 80s, that these and this charge, and it was not just housing. All manner of social programs were cut during the Reagan administration. And this was not just a misstep. This was a plan to shrink the footprint of the federal government. Payments for people with disabilities, people who are physically and mentally disabled, are normally by law entitled to disability support. It became much harder. And this was a decision the administration made to make getting these benefits much harder. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of people were kicked off. So these are very vulnerable people who needed these benefits and were not able to get them. So these are huge shifts that happen. And this is, you mentioned philosophy. I mean, this is a shift in philosophy also. During the New Deal era, the idea was, you know, there's this idea of the common good. And this changes pretty dramatically to a philosophy of bootstraps. You're kind of on your own. And the administration, in fact, took the position that homelessness is a choice. It didn't acknowledge that this is a social problem, but rather this is a problem of individual choice. People were choosing to be on the streets. It was a lifestyle choice. There was no responsibility of the federal government to address this crisis. So that was the situation at that time.
So here you're talking about the Reagan years, 1982. This is second full year in office. But then Bill Clinton becomes president and Barack Obama becomes president. We have Democratic presidents who you would think are more liberal. Does this philosophy shift?
Not really, not fundamentally. I think that there was a fundamental shift that happened of philosophy that was never fully reversed. So the numbers, the cuts in housing, for example, have never been restored. They've been increased. And especially now, I would say during
cuts, cuts have been increased?
I'm sorry, I didn't say that correctly. The funds have increased, but not fully restored. So Clinton is a good, this is no longer a simple partisan issue. I think it started in the Reagan era, but certainly Clinton campaigned on a promise to end welfare as we know it, to end. This was another program started during the New Deal era that Clinton campaigned on a promise to end. And he repealed this very, very minimal benefit, which supported poor families and with children, and also continued this narrative of personal choice that Reagan started, that, you know, we've got to give people incentive to work as if, you know, otherwise people will not be motivated. So it was not something that was reversed. And even during Obama, the Obama administration, another thing happened that was also a critical point, which was the Great Recession. You mentioned that earlier, and you're right, that was also a critical point in time when people, it was almost like the earlier crisis point during the early Reagan years, a almost similar thing happened with a new wave of homelessness. People, the foreclosure crisis, people lost their homes. And some of those people became homeless, and renters also suffered during the foreclosure crisis. People who were renting from people who were foreclosed on became homeless. So that was another wave of homelessness during the 2000s, during the Obama administration.
And we haven't recovered from that. It's gotten worse.
Well, it's gotten worse. I mean, there was, you know, often what we do in these situations is there's some help, and there was help during the Obama administration, but it was just, it was like a 1 year shot of help that did help people out of homelessness and prevent homelessness for some people, but then that was it. And yeah, so we did not recover from that. It's gotten worse because in the meantime, so it's not just government, it's also what's happening in the private sector. The cost of housing is skyrocketing. So, you know, the housing assistance that exists now, so staying with government for a moment. So the housing assistance that exists now is primarily something called vouchers. So if you're very poor, you are eligible to get a housing voucher from the federal and state government combined. This is supposed to help you go out on the market and rent a place, pay for housing.
But rents are increasing.
Rents are increasing. Not only are rents increasing, you don't have a right to this. In other words, you can get this only so long as Congress is funding it. And now, and for years, Congress has not funded this sufficiently. So right now, only 1 in 4 of people who are poor enough to be eligible for this kind of help actually receive it. Only 1 in 4, because there's not enough money.
So government's involvement here has not kept up with the economic conditions that essentially is a product of real estate prices just creeping right up constantly.
Exactly.
You said that this is not a partisan issue, and that made me think. You know, we see more homelessness. I'll just talk about two cities I'm familiar with. In three cities at this point now, Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. I've spent a great deal of time in these three big cities, and they all happen to be democratically based cities. So sort of what we see in popular culture seems to be different than what you're proposing. That, or are there homeless people also in Republican states that we just don't talk about?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. There are plenty of homeless people in Florida, for example, or in Texas. I mean, there are homeless people all over the country. They're not limited to Democratic or Republican states. There are homeless people everywhere. This is a national problem. This is not limited to San Francisco or New York or LA.
Is it as bad, let's say, in Texas and Florida as these three big cities that I identified?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are issues that exist everywhere. You know, you're talking about cities that are particularly dense and have large populations in general, but there are plenty of homeless people and there's plenty of housing need and lack of affordable housing in these other states and cities there. Absolutely.
You know, going back from the 1970s on, we talked about politics and Congress and funding. Now, this makes me think of us, just ordinary Americans, you and I. Do you think our attitudes as a people towards homelessness has changed?
That's a hard question to answer. There are polls that have been conducted on public attitudes towards homelessness.
Ah.
And polls show that people are very concerned, and actually people fear becoming homeless themselves. And that polls also show that people think, the public thinks, that the federal government should be doing more and identifies homelessness as related to housing and the lack of affordable housing. So that's what polls show. I think, if anything, they're showing some increased decreased support for approaches to homelessness that we call criminalizing homelessness, which many cities have adopted, particularly in the past, you know, since the 90s, many cities have adopted laws that are intended to push homeless people out of sight, and we call those criminalization of homelessness.
So based on public polling, it shows that people now are less in favor of that tough legal approach to homelessness.
Yes. Yes, that's what polls show. Now, you know, you can, polls are a funny thing, and, you know, they can, you can read them in different ways. I mean, certainly. But I do think there's validity. I do think that people are increasingly understanding that homelessness is a housing problem, and they're increasingly relating the housing costs, which rising housing costs, which are now affecting more and more people, ordinary people, as you described it, are being affected by rising housing costs. And I think seeing the connection to homelessness increasingly. And so that, you know, that I think drives an increasing view that simply trying to push people out of sight or out of cities is not the way to go, that what's needed is to address the housing problem.
You know, since polls are in favor of doing something about homelessness, you know, whether it's funding or other programs, do you think politicians are not responsive and the right steps are not being taken? Because in the list of things that we need to do in our country, it just falls to, I don't know, number 7, 8, 9, 10. Is that the case?
That's a hard question to answer. Yes, I think that it's in terms of politicians' priorities, this is not a top priority. Now, consider what happened during COVID, though. We just went through this experience of the pandemic. Yeah. And that was the time that really brought to the fore, I think, what it means to not have a home. You know, remember, the first thing that happened with a pandemic, stay at home, wash your hands, isolate. All of those things are impossible to do if you don't have a home. If you don't have a sink, how are you going to wash your hands? If you don't have a room, how are you going to isolate? So this, I think, really brought in stark relief what it means to not have a home and how important, how critical it is to have a home, to have housing. And during the time of the pandemic, there were public policies put in place that addressed the needs of homeless people specifically. And, you know, cities
addressed their needs with regards to COVID?
Well, yeah, with regards to COVID in terms of having a place to be. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the CDC recommended, strongly urged cities to put people in individual housing units, if at all possible. There were studies that came out that showed how vulnerable people are. People who are homeless, homelessness is not good for your health, generally.
Yeah.
And so tend to already have all of these, you know, like high blood pressure, chronic diseases, respiratory illnesses that make you more vulnerable to getting COVID, to becoming severely ill, to dying.
Professor Foscarinas, were there any studies that showed that a larger proportion of homeless people caught COVID in comparison to the general population. I bet that was the case.
Yes, yes. There are, and there were actually studies that showed this.
Oh, wow. That
homeless people were more vulnerable to getting COVID, and they were, let's see, the 3 to 5 times more likely to be hospitalized or to be in intensive care if they got it. And so more likely to get it, more likely to be severely ill, more likely to be in intensive care than the general population by a lot.
Let's take a break here. We'll be right back to talk about laws and homelessness.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Professor Foscarinas, as a country, do we deal with homelessness at the local level as we did with healthcare mandates during COVID, for example? We just talked about it. The CDC promulgates guidelines, but they were not necessarily mandates unless it was for sort of intercommerce, travel, and all of that. Or do we have national laws for homelessness, kind of like similar to, I guess, immigration?
So we do have national laws, and this, the first major national law, first major federal law to address homelessness was enacted in 1987.
1987, so okay.
Yes, at the sort of right at the time when the crisis was first burgeoning. And this was is legislation which is still the major federal legislation addressing homelessness. It was, when it was first enacted, it was meant to be an emergency response. And I know this because I worked to get it enacted.
What was the name of that act?
So it's now called the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. And it was named after two members of Congress, Stuart McKinney, a Republican, and Bruce Vento, a Democrat, who were the lead sponsors and the major forces behind it. And it was originally supposed, it was part one of what was a comprehensive proposal at the time. It was part one, which was the emergency part, and it remained really the only part. It was supposed to be followed by longer-term solutions, but the legislation as it was enacted was focused on emergency relief, so emergency shelter, not solely, but primarily on emergency solutions like shelter. And getting this enacted was actually a major feat because this was during the time of Reagan, who denied that this was even a problem. He certainly denied that it was not an issue for the federal government.
Yeah, he started in 1982, as you talked about in the prior segment.
Right.
Yeah,
but he signed it into law because it was that's how it was enacted, because it was supported by large bipartisan majorities in Congress. That's the basic law.
By the way, in here you said you were involved in pushing this law through. Did you work in Congress back then?
No, I was an advocate.
You were an advocate.
I spent the majority of my career as an advocate. I actually left a law firm job in New York to move to Washington to advocate on behalf. I was, at the time, I took a job with to establish an office for the National Coalition for the Homeless, which was then based in New York. and to advocate for a federal response to what was clearly a growing national crisis. So homelessness emerges in the 80s as a national crisis. That seemed to suggest that a federal response was urgently needed. And so that's how I got involved in this issue as an advocate and to persuade Congress and federal agencies that they had to do something, to building a coalition of groups around the country and people who were concerned about this to put pressure on Congress.
And it seems like it was a bipartisan coalition. The name of the act has one Democrat, one Republican.
Right.
Okay, right. That becomes sort of the seminal law, but it's an emergency act, as you described it. Yeah, okay.
Right. So over the years, so it's a funny thing. Something is passed and then, you know, it tends to be forgotten about. It gets harder then. It can get harder to then go the next step. So what ended up happening is that funding increased. We were able to get funding increased for this act. We were able to get it reshaped in some ways to focus more on longer term solutions, but not to really increase the funding enough to put those solutions in place. So over
time, seems like it's a law without teeth, really, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it has some teeth, but yes, you're absolutely right. It's a law that is grossly underfunded. So what happened is during the George W. Bush administration, the law shifted to put a priority on something called Housing First. So Housing First is a programmatic strategy which says, let's not put people in emergency shelters. That doesn't solve the problem. Housing solves homelessness, not shelter. And that you can actually, there's been a lot of success with this model where, you know, someone is offered housing and whatever services they might need once they're in the housing are then offered as well. So say somebody is mentally ill and needs mental health care or substance abuse treatment. First, they have to have housing because these services will not be effective without them. Can't, you know, maintain a mental health treatment regimen or a substance abuse treatment plan if you're on the street or in your shelter. You need a place to live. And a lot of people also don't need those treatments. They just need a place to live. So provide the housing. That's called Housing First.
This sounds really positive.
It is very positive. Okay. However, it's not funded. This is occurring within, I mean, this is what, and this, this is within a context where we're still basically with this original legislation from 1987. Yes, the funding has increased, but not to the extent that is necessary, certainly not to make up for this total, these cutbacks that occurred going back to the 1980s. So as a result of the New Deal, there's the beginnings of some programs to ensure that people have housing and that everyone can afford housing. These get hollowed out in the 80s and never get put back together. And then we have this little new law that is targeted at homeless people. And then we decide to ask it to also take on housing, but we don't provide the funding for it to do that.
So I'm sorry, what do you mean by new law? You're not talking about
19... I'm talking the 1987 law.
Okay, that's same thing.
Law,
okay, yeah.
Responding to this crisis.
Yeah.
And which is the probably predictable result of cutting all the housing funding, but it's not commensurate to the problem. So the new law, 1987, starts with shelter, In the 2009, actually, it formalizes this commitment, which actually was first adopted by George W. Bush, but becomes formally part of this law in 2009. But the funding does not increase to allow it to really solve the problem. So, you know, what do we expect right now? There's a study that shows that, you know, each year people exit homelessness, but each year a greater number of people enter it. So there are programs that get people out of homelessness, but the same causes that are driving people into it are still there and they're getting worse.
Has the U.S. Supreme Court weighed into this?
No, not really. So the U.S. Supreme Court, there's been quite a lot of litigation challenging what I called earlier the criminalization of homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some recent rulings at the federal appeals court level that it's unconstitutional to criminally punish someone for living in public when they have no other place to be.
That's a big case.
Yes, that's not Supreme Court though. These are federal appeals court.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're
one of the Fed circuits. Okay.
Right. In particular, the Ninth Circuit has had two major decisions in the past 5 years that are very strong on this point. It's cruel and unusual punishment violates the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution to make it a crime for someone to sleep on the street when they have no other place to go.
Oh, wow. Is this going up to the Supreme Court?
Well, so the first case, which was in 2018, the cities petitioned for the Supreme Court to review. The Supreme Court declined review. Now there's another case that they are petitioning again the Supreme Court to review. I hope it does not, because I am afraid of what this Supreme Court might do.
But, oh, you're afraid that if the Supreme Court grants cert on this, it's a more conservative Supreme Court, so they may actually uphold these local criminalization
laws. That's what I'm afraid
of. Yeah.
I don't think that there's a reason for it to, because there's no split in the circuits, which is one of the criteria for the Supreme Court to review something.
Yeah.
And I don't think these rulings from the Ninth Circuit are grounded in much earlier Supreme Court precedent. I don't think there's any reason for this Supreme Court to revisit that. And the earlier Supreme Court precedent was not on homelessness specifically, but it was on the more general issue of, can you criminally punish somebody for involuntary conduct or for status? Maybe you've heard of this. Can you punish someone for their status? No, you cannot. That's unconstitutional.
You mean status as being homeless? Is that what you mean?
Right. And it's so, not to get too technical, but the argument here is that if somebody is homeless, the status of being, and they have no other place to sleep but on the street, then if you're punishing them for doing that, it's essentially punishing their status, because they have no choice. And you can also think of it in terms of punishing something that's involuntary, that's otherwise harmless, and it's necessary to life. It's life sustaining. Everybody has to sleep. And so that's the general principle that was that is based on these older Supreme Court cases that are well established.
I see. Before we conclude this segment, I just want to make sure I have this correctly. 1982, Reaganomics comes in and they cut a bunch of housing. It goes from 300,000 housing units to 3,000, 1%. 1987, it's just the situation. We have a crisis. They come out with this emergency act, bipartisan. You're involved in it and pushing it through. And that 1987 act essentially is our national homelessness law. It gets tweaked a little bit in 2009, housing first. But that's it. That's our national federal homelessness law.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Professor Foscarinas as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Professor Foscarinas, in the last three segments, we talked about the problem of homelessness. You know, we had it in the Great Depression, then it picked up again in the late 1970s and got worse in the 1980s, and here we are. So let's talk about solutions. Do you have any solutions for this recalcitrant problem?
Yes, I do.
Oh, wonderful.
So we know the solutions. I think collectively we have the solution. Housing First has been known to work. It's evidence-based. It means it's backed up by lots of studies that show that it works. The problem is we need the structure around it. So by that, I mean, we need a commitment to housing in this country. We need to start thinking of housing as a basic human right. In this country now, we basically have commodified housing. What that means is that housing has gotten disconnected from human need. It's an investment vehicle. The other trend, we talked about how the cost of housing is skyrocketing. Developers are building housing, charging as, you know, whatever the market will bear. There's also investors, institutional investors buying housing, even building housing for profit. And it's become disconnected from people's needs. It doesn't have to be this way. So Finland is an example of a country that has very nearly solved homelessness. Oh. Now it's a smaller country by far, that's mm-hmm. for sure. But it also has a very different approach. It invests in what it calls social housing. So affordable housing, housing that is affordable to extremely poor people, but it's not limited to very poor people. It's social housing for a variety of income levels. It's mixed income housing. And it invests in this. It invests money in this, and it also invests in other kinds of social supports. So if you're so poor that you can't even afford the social housing, there's a housing benefit that you can get that will help you pay for it. So that's a model that is working.
Is investing in that model taking up a big chunk of Finland's economy, GDP?
I don't have the numbers on GDP, but I do know that they are also saving money because homelessness is expensive. And I do have some numbers, if I can quickly think of them. They have actually evaluated this, and they save more money than they spend through this investment.
Because they're solving the problem.
They're solving the problem. And homelessness costs money. So it's easy for us to think, sitting here in the US, that, well, doing nothing doesn't cost anything. But that's not true. And there are studies here in the US that show that doing nothing is actually very costly because you're spending money. When you allow people to be homeless, first of all, their health deteriorates. It's, you know, physical health, mental health, everything deteriorates. People can acquire mental illness or acquire substance abuse addiction just by being homeless. And, you know, people tend not to have health insurance and end up in the ER. Things progress and they end up in the emergency room for basic health care, which will become a crisis. That's expensive.
Extremely expensive.
Extremely expensive. Cities spend money on police because they enact these laws that criminalize people for being in public. That costs money. So between healthcare costs, emergency room, police, this is all, we're spending a lot of money on homelessness without solving the problem. And because we're not solving the problem continues and it gets worse. And then that is becomes even more expensive. So Finland is actually saving money by solving the problem. So I think, and there are other models of social housing, and you know, Austria has a model of social housing. So I think the basic idea, and there are groups here in the US working on this, and the basic idea is to acknowledge that everybody needs a home, everybody needs a place to live, and that we as a country have to invest in making that a reality. We have to recognize housing as a basic human right. And that is increasingly being talked about in public policy circles. I've been talking about this for a long time, and advocates have been. At first, we would be laughed at, but now it's being taken seriously.
When we talk about housing as a basic human right, it seems like this would be a whole new law act. This is much different in scope than the 1987 law, which is sort of a emergency response. This is no longer just a response. This is a whole new paradigm shift that right. Housing. Okay. So exactly. Have any political movements started towards this?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, there's been rhetorical movement. For example, the Biden administration, President Biden did say when he came into office, housing should be a right and not a privilege. He was one of, there were, I think, four presidential candidates during that election who made this statement of housing as a human right.
Has he done anything about it?
Well, he proposed, remember, Build Back Better, the ill-fated
Yes.
Well, he did propose expanding the housing voucher program so that everybody who was eligible for it would get it. And that was torpedoed. But, you know, I think there are efforts at the local level. Right now, there's an effort in California to amend the state constitution to include the right to housing. And there are groups working at the local level to promote social housing. So Seattle, for example, just adopted legislation, but it was by ballot initiative that creates a city agency to be a developer of social housing. So that's important. I mean, these are small steps. They're not going to by themselves solve the national problem, but this is putting us on a path in that direction. And I think that that's exciting.
Professor Foscarinas, I'm going to ask you a question that is going to, I'm very nervous about asking this question because it's going to sound silly, but you hear it, so I want to ask it. You talked about, we're going back to housing first, and you said it's evidence-based that this works. In many circles, especially more conservative circles, whether it's on TV, I don't want to name any TV channels, or even friends, you hear people saying housing doesn't work because homeless people wander off. They don't come back. I have no evidence about this. I'm just telling you you hear this from time to time. Is this just hodgepodge? You're saying this is evidence-based that it works.
This is evidence-based that it works. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The people in housing stay in housing, and you know, their homelessness is solved. I mean, there will always be exceptions to everything, but you know, the evidence is that the vast majority of people who go into housing as part of Housing First stay and remain housed.
And I want to emphasize here that when you say housing, we're distinguishing this from shelters.
Yes.
Okay.
This is permanent housing, permanent affordable housing. And it doesn't, when I talk about a right to housing, I don't mean everybody gets a housing for free. You know, people can pay, you know, many people have some income either through work or through, say, disability benefits, and can pay some proportion of their income for rent. But the housing has to be affordable, so that someone who's very poor can live there.
In the minute we have left of our conversation, I just wanted to ask you about the National Homelessness Law Center, which you founded. Love to learn a little bit about it.
So the organization uses the power of the law to end and prevent homelessness. And the idea is law is a powerful tool, and you can use law to, you can make new laws, you can enforce laws that already exist. And the idea of the organization is to work in partnership with people who experience homelessness to advocate for solutions, to advocate for housing as a human right, and you know, to advance that struggle. The organization partners with many groups around the country, like the local level groups that I talked about, and also brings together a lot of volunteer lawyers who donate their time and resources and services.
Is this when you say law, are we going back to the criminalization of homelessness, or are there various different types of things for people being kicked out of their apartments or evictions?
Well, there are different things. Yeah. I mean, there are many different things. There's issues involving homeless kids and their right to go to school.
Oh, wow.
Domestic violence survivors.
Why would that even be an issue? Of course they have a right to go to school. This is an issue.
Yes, that was an issue addressed in this early 1987 law that was a significant issue. That 1987 law said that if you're a homeless child, you have a right to go to school. And there's been, this is something that I and others have litigated because, it's not always been complied with.
I wouldn't have thought that would ever be an issue. In fact, you would have thought it would be the other way around. You would want to take in homeless children and Professor Foscarinas, if you wanted our audience to remember just one point about homelessness in America after everything we talked about, what would that point be?
Homelessness can be solved. We need to acknowledge that housing is a basic human right. It's a basic human need, and it has to be recognized and treated as a basic human right. That's how we end homelessness.
Yeah. Professor Foscarinas, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research. And we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.